who remembers something from yesterday's class. Or the day before.
Yesterday was Lord Nityananda.
Yes, you remembered something.
I thought
you
were
going to
tonight's
class. Yes. Okay. What do you remember about Lord Nityananda? Might as well get some great blessings.
That he somehow the villagers would ask him, how did such a small boy know so much about this Krishna Lila? And he simply smiled and said, these are my pastimes.
Very good. How about the day before? I mean, no.
That's a little far.
No, but that's wonderful. Once the spark comes, then the devotee's memories will ignite in great remembrances of the what's the place. Yes, Abhati.
A glance of Lord Krishna can deliver devotees from the blindness of materialism. And also purify the devotee.
I have a question. Yes.
Krishna again glorified the devotees and the brahmanas above, the holy places and the holy waters. Again, a similar verse.
In the Krishna book, that chapter, does anyone know the title of that chapter? Krishna blesses his devotees, I believe. So the three things that take place are all about Krishna's very intimate dealings with his devotees and what the lengths he will go to please his devotees. Even in the case of Arjuna, he will take the side of his devotee even against the will of Balaram. Quite amazing. And why? Here's my question. Why? Balaram was very angry, and what did he? Why was Balaram angry? But that's not only why he was angry. Arjuna had cheated him. Why? He came in the dress of a sannyasi, and his purpose was just to kidnap his younger sister, and they treated him so nicely, with all respect. He even asked Subhadra to serve him, this nice sannyasi. And then look what he did. He was such a cheater. And of course, the master of cheaters was behind it all. But then Balaram was very angry, and what did he want to do? What did he want to do?
Got a contingent of his army and blast them.
Yes. In colloquial language, something like that. What did he want to do? He wanted to kill him. Why didn't he kill him?
Krishna really managed to get his feet and...
And what did Krishna do? Did you mention that? How did...
Subhadra wanted to marry Arjuna.
Yeah, he pointed out, look, and it's been said somewhere that he didn't point to. What did he show?
Subhadra is carrying.
Huh?
Subhadra is carrying now. Subhadra is carrying Arjuna. Not Arjuna is carrying.
Yeah, is that... You've heard that? Where?
It is not there, but...
It is not there. Subhadra was carrying Arjuna? That's a stream. I would imagine that would be... some rasa vasa.
She was smiling at him.
But what I had heard, that she was... I mean, after all, Arjuna was a great warrior. How would that have looked? The armies are attacking him. Subhadra's carrying Arjuna. But what I had heard, that she was driving the chariot. See? She's driving the chariot. It's her desire. That's like your girl. So now we move on. After hearing Krishna's wonderful dealings with his devotees, and there's also some very interesting hidden things in there, but we won't mention those now. But now we move on to a chapter that of the Bhagavatam that often we tend to avoid the prayers of the personified Vedas. And the purpose of this, and also in the next chapter, and the following chapter, those 87, 88, and 89 would show that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In 87, that he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, established by the Vedas, because one can ask, oh, you're saying that Krishna is the Supreme Lord, but what do the Vedas say? Because in culture, in this proper culture, everything is established by the Vedas, not I think this should be done, I think that should be done, but by the Shastra, by the Vedas. And then in the next chapter, Lord Shiva will be shown to be dependent upon Krishna in the pastime of Vikasura. And then in the next chapter, even Mahavishnu is shown by the incredibly wonderful comments of Śrīla Viṣṇava Chakravarti Thakur to be that Krishna will be the master of even Mahavishnu. So in this chapter, the Vedas will be shown to be all directly or indirectly glorifying the Lord, Lord Krishna. So there's a tricky question here that's asked. Prakrit Maharaj asks, O Brahmana, how can the Vedas directly describe the absolute truth, who cannot be described in words? Because we've seen this absolute truth act in such amazing ways, and also ways that one wouldn't expect the absolute truth to act, as we have seen him act in relationship to his sister Subhadra, and also even just that the Supreme Absolute Truth has a sister. So how is it possible that the Absolute Truth, who cannot be described in words, because he's beyond, he's transcendental, how can the Vedas describe him? He's transcendental. The material sound vibrations come from the material tongue. The tongue is composed of blood and all kinds of other tissues. And it's matter, clearly matter. And the vocal cords are also clearly matter. And how can the material tongue vibrate a transcendental sound? This is part of essentially what the question is. How can matter be used to describe transcendence, something that is beyond matter? And this is very much the impersonalist point of view. The question continues. The Vedas are limited to describing the qualities of material nature. What verse in the Bhagavad Gita? But the Supreme is devoid of these qualities. So the Vedas basically describe the three modes of material nature and how to manipulate the material energy by manipulating the three modes of material nature, but the Supreme Lord doesn't have anything to do with the modes of material nature, being transcendental to all material manifestations and their cause. The causes are the three modes of material nature, and the material manifestations are that which are caused by the three modes of nature. So how can the Vedas describe something that has nothing to do with the modes of material nature? How can anything material describe something spiritual? That's the essential question. So, because it's such an interesting and philosophical question, and important, the great commentaries on this, we won't be able to go through them all in detail, but we'll pick parts which give the essence of the message of each of the different verses, and we'll get an understanding of what's going on. So that's the question, the basic question. Now Śrīla Swami will have a verse. He's composed of the verse at the end of each of the verses which are spoken by the Shrutis or the Vedic literatures. And he's commented elaborately on these texts, and he had his commentaries quoted here, and also something from Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, just offering their respects to this chapter. So the purport. Beginning his commentary on this chapter, Srila Sridhar Swami prays, Vagisya yasya vadane lakshmi yasya chavachase yasyasti vide sambit tamna sringam maham vaje. Because revered Swami Charan, Sridhar Swami, is a devotee of Lakshmi Nisringate. I worship Lord Nisringa, within whose mouth resides the great masters of eloquence, upon whose chest resides the goddess of fortune, and within whose heart resides the divine potency of consciousness. So he's taking shelter of Lord Nisringadev in this way to be able to speak. Sampadaya Vasudhartam Sriya Nivandayantrita Sruti Stuti Mitavyakyam Karishyami Yitamati. Desiring to purify my sampradaya and being bound by duty, I will briefly comment on the prayers of the personified Vedas to the best of my realization. Srimad Bhagavatam Purvai Sarata Sanise Vitam Maya Tu Tad Upaspristam Uchistam Upachiyate. Inasmuch as Srimad Bhagavatam has already been perfectly honored by my predecessors, explanations, I can only gather together the remnants of what they have honored. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur offers his own invocation. Mama Ratna Vanagbhavam Ratnya Pari Chinvataha Hasantu Santu Vimrenmi Naswa Svanta Vinodkritaha Vinodakrit. The saintly devotees may laugh at me for becoming a jewel merchant, though I know nothing about precious jewels, but I feel no shame, for at least I may entertain them. Though I have no wisdom, devotion, or detachment, I am still greedy to take the philosopher's stone of the Veda's prayers from the fortress in which it is being kept. It's not easy to enter a fortress. If the wind of indiscretion, my failure to acknowledge my lowly position, threatens to knock me down, then while writing this commentary, I must hold on to the effulgent pillars of the feet of Sridhar Swami, Sanatana Goswami, and Lord Sri Krishna. Pranamya Sri Gurum Bhuya Sri Krishnam Karunarvanam Lokanatam Jagat Chakshu Sri Sukham Tam Upasraye. Repeatedly bowing down to my divine spiritual master, and to Lord Sri Krishna, the ocean of mercy, I take shelter of Sri Sukadev Goswami, the protector of the world and its universal eye. So, this is the mood in which these two great acharyas, that they approach this chapter, so with great reverence. So, again, the question is, how can the Vedas, which are composed of physical words, and the tongue, which is composed of matter, describes something beyond the physical? And this is basically the impersonalist position, that because all form that is perceived, and that which we can perceive with our material eyes and the sense objects, everything is material. So how can we perceive anything of transcendence? So one can easily take the agnostic position with this, that no one can say anything about God, His existence, or His non-existence, His qualities, or His non-qualities, because here we are, tiny and significant in matter. So that's the basic issue. So at the end of the last chapter, Sukadev Goswami, this we're reading in the purport here, told Purohit Maharaj, O King, the personality of Godhead, who is a devotee of His own devotees, that's what we saw in the last chapter, that Krishna is a devotee of His own devotees. He satisfied three of His devotees in wonderful ways in the last chapter. And one of the wonderful things He did, because one may think that here I am, I become a devotee, but Krishna has so many devotees. So how is he going to take care of me? He's going. He's so busy with so many devotees. How can he possibly also take care of me? And that type of a mood can hold us back from surrendering. And we saw that how Krishna dealt with that in the last chapter. How did he go to the homes of two of his devotees at the same time, which is impossible, but to do the impossible isn't even difficult, not to speak of impossible of Krishna. So the king, the personality of Godhead, who was a devotee of his own devotees, stayed for some time with his two great devotees, teaching them how perfect saints behave. Then he returned to Dwarka. In this verse, the word sanmargam could be understood in at least three ways. In the first, sat is taken to mean devotee of the Supreme Lord, and thus sanmargam means the path of bhakti yoga, devotional service. In the second, with sat meaning a seeker of transcendental knowledge, sanmargam means the philosophical path of knowledge. Sanmargam, the final verse in 59, here it's translated Sanmargam, he's teaching the path of the sat of the devotees of the pure souls. So Sanmargam means the path of bhakti yoga. It could also mean the path of philosophical knowledge, which has impersonal Brahman as its object. And in the third, with sat referring to the transcendental sound of the Vedas, sanmarga means the process of following Vedic instructions. Both the second and third of these interpretations of sanmarga lead to the question of how the Vedas can describe the absolute truth. Srila Sridhar Swami elaborately analyzes the problem, this problem, in terms of the traditional disciplines of Sanskrit poetics. We could consider the words have three kinds of expressive capacities called shabdavrittis. These are the different ways a word refers to its meanings, distinguished as mukhyavritti, lakshanavritti, and gonavritti. The shabdavritti turn mukhya. So this is the way the interpretive meanings of the words. Shabdavritti term mukhya is the primary literal meaning of a word. This is also known as the abhida, a word's denotation or dictionary meaning. So there's different meanings that words have. The first is this shabdavritti, mukhyavritti, which means the dictionary meaning. Mukhyavritti is further divided into two subcategories, namely rudhi and yoga. Our primary meaning is called rudhi when it is based on conventional usage, and yoga when it is derived from another word's meaning by regular etymological rules. For example, the word go, cow, an example of rudhi, since its relation with its literal meaning is purely conventional. So go means cow. Very simple. The denotation of the word panchaka, chef, on the other hand, is a yoga vritti, through the word's derivation from the word from the root pach, to cook, by addition of the agent suffix ka. So there's words that are derived from other words and words that have their own meaning directly. So these are the mukhyavrittis. Beside its mukhyavritti, or primary meaning, because we're talking about how can the absolute truth be derived or understood or spoken of, described in the Vedas. So here's some preliminary Sanskrit thinking. Beside its mukhyavritti, or primary meaning, a word can also be used in a secondary metaphorical sense. This usage is called lakshana. The rule, lakshana is sometimes referred to as a secondary meaning. The rule is that a word should not be understood metaphorically if its mukhyavritti makes sense in the given context. Only after the mukhyavritti fails to convey a word's meaning may lakshanavritti be justifiably presumed. feel free to tell the dog to be quiet. So desire, we won't complain. The function of Lakshan is technically explained in the Kavya Shastras as an extended reference, pointing to something in some way related to the object of the literal meaning. Thus the phrase Gangayam Gosha literally means the cowherd village in the Gangi, in the Ganga, in the Ganges. But that idea is absurd, that there's a cowherd village, and this is, they always use the same examples, all the same ones, yes? All the time, and Devadatta also, he comes up all the time. So, obviously a cowherd village can't be in the Ganga, literally, yeah? Because otherwise it would be very wet. But that idea is absurd. So here, Gangayam should rather be understood by its lakshana vritti to mean on the bank of the Ganga, even though the literal meaning is in the bank of the Ganga. The bank being something related to the river. Gona vritti is a special kind of lakshana. So mukhya and lakshana vrittis each have different subdivisions, where the meaning is extended to some idea of similarity. For example, the statement, Singho Devadatta Ha, Devadatta is a lion. Heroic Devadatta is metaphorically called a lion because of his lion-like qualities. In contrast, the example of the general kind of lakshana, namely Gangayam Goshaha, involves a relationship not of similarity but of location. In this first verse of the 87th chapter, Parikshit Maharaj expresses doubt as to how the words of the Vedas can refer to the absolute truth by any of the valid kinds of shabda vritti. He asks, Katam shakshad charanti. How can the Vedas directly describe Brahman by rudya mukhya vritti, rudya vritti, or mukhya vritti? Literal meaning based on convention. After all, the Absolute is anirdesha, inaccessible to designations. The Absolute Truth has no designation, so therefore it's not going to be describable by those vrittis. And how can the Vedas even describe Brahman by guna vritti, metaphor based on similar qualities? The Vedas are guna vrittaya, full of qualitative descriptions, but Brahman is nirguna, without qualities. Obviously, a metaphor based on similar qualities cannot apply in the case of something that has no qualities. Yes? It's obvious? You can't have a metaphor of comparison. This is compared to that. This is blue, and the air has no qualities that you can see, so how can you compare this to the air? Because it doesn't have visible qualities. So, since the Vedas, the point being that the Vedas the Absolute Truth is nirguna, it has no qualities according to this analysis, how could it could be compared to anything or described? Because these vrittis can't be directly described or by comparatively described. Parikshit Maharaj points out that Brahman is sad ashataha param, beyond all causes and effects, having no connection with any manifest existence, subtle or gross. The Absolute cannot be expressed by either yoga vritti, a meaning derived etymologically, or lakshana, metaphor, since both require some relationship of Brahman to other entities, because the Absolute Truth is made of spiritual substance. Of course, these questions are coming more from the impersonal point of view. But the idea is that you can't compare it to anything of this material world because it has no material qualities. It is spiritual. It is not material. So how are you going to describe it? How are you going to say anything about it? Either Gona, Mukhya, etc. Who beeps? Not only do we have to turn off our mobile phones, we have to turn off our beepers and boopers, both. So this is the basic idea. Since the spiritual is of a different energy, how can something of this world, which the Vedas are, and also how can our tongues, which is of this world, describe something that has no qualities of course, they, from the impersonalist point of view, having no qualities, or from the bhakti point of view, how can it describe something that has no material qualities? And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains this point in Madhurya Kadambini, that basically he says that when all the descriptions that we have of Krishna, when one actually perceives the Lord directly as Sakshat Darshan, that they fall completely short. They have nothing to do with Krishna. We can say that Krishna is the color of a fresh rain cloud, effulgently fresh monsoon rain cloud. But the rain clouds that we have our experience of are all of the material world, and Krishna isn't the color of anything in the material world. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur makes the same point. So how can we describe it? The same question. How can we describe the absolute truth using our conceptual abilities, which are grounded in matter? So here, the question is going to be answered, but indirectly. And let's see if there's anything that has to be read from the, directly from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, although our commentators have, in the BBT edition, they have taken much from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Sri Goswami, etc., throughout, and Sri Jiva Goswami throughout. Let me see if there's anything we should take from here right now. Yes. This is already there, technical. Okay. Now here's the answer to this question. Sukadeva Goswami said, does anyone have any questions about the question? What the question is? Okay. And here's the answer. And it's going to be somewhat indirect, but our acharyas will give it a clear meaning and give us a clear understanding. The Supreme Lord manifested the material intelligence, senses, mind, and vital air of the living entities so that they can indulge their desires for sense gratification, take repeated births to engage in fruitive activities, become elevated in future lives, and ultimately attain liberation. So the question was, how can the Vedas manifest an understanding of the absolute truth and describe the absolute truth? And the answer is, the Supreme Lord manifested the material intelligence, the senses, the mind, the vital air of the living entities for his purposes in relationship to the living entities. And so he has manifested the material world. The Supreme Lord manifested the material world, intelligence, senses, mind, and prana, vital air. For what purpose? So that they can indulge their desires for sense gratification, take repeated births to engage in fruitive activities, become elevated to the higher planetary systems, and ultimately attain liberation. So one may ask, what does this have to do with the particular question that's been asked? So if we are patient, it shall be revealed, not even gradually. Purport. At the dawn of creation, when the conditioned living entities lay dormant within the transcendental body of Lord Vishnu, he initiated the process of creation by sending forth the coverings of intelligence, mind, and so forth, and so on, for the living entities' benefit. As stated here, Vishnu is the independent Lord, the Prabhu, and the living entities are his jana, dependents. Thus we should understand that the Lord creates the cosmos entirely for the living entity's sake. Compassion is the sole motive. By providing the living entities with gross and subtle bodies, the Supreme Lord enables them to pursue sense gratification, and in the human form, religiosity, economic development, and liberation. In each body, the conditioned soul utilizes his senses for enjoyment. And when he comes to the human form, he must also discharge various duties assigned to him at the different stages of his life. If he faithfully discharges his duties, he earns more refined and extensive enjoyment in the future. If not, he is degraded. And when the soul eventually hankers to be freed from material life, the path of liberation is always available. So this is, so far we haven't touched the question, just an explanation of the purpose of creation. But the point is being made clearly that this creation has behind it the living entity, the supreme living entity, the supreme personality of Godhead, who manifests the creation for the benefit of the living entities, all the different souls. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti comments that in this verse, the repeated use of the word cha and indicates the importance of all what the Lord provides, not only the path of liberation, because he gives them facilities for sense enjoyment, repeated birth, into new facilities according to their desires, and also liberation. So everything is important. So not only the path of liberation, but also the paths of gradual elevation through religious life and appropriate sense enjoyment. In all their endeavors, the living entities depend on the Lord's mercy for success. Without intelligence, senses, mind, and vital air, the living entities cannot achieve anything. So the point is here that we're dependent on the Lord. And it is His divine will and divine mercy and His divine plan that has manifested the universe for our benefit. So without Him, without His mercy, and the mercy that comes from the things that He's created, which is also His mercy, we cannot achieve anything. Neither liberation to heaven, elevation to heaven, purification through knowledge, perfection of the Eightfold Meditation or Yoga, nor pure devotion through following the process of Bhakti Yoga, beginning with hearing and chanting the names of God. So all four processes. Elevation to heaven, which process is that?
Karma.
Purification through knowledge.
Yoga.
Perfection of the Eightfold Meditation on Yoga. Yoga. No pure devotion through following the processes of Bhakti Yoga, beginning with hearing and chanting. So all of them, not just Bhakti, is dependent on His mercy. Completely, because we're using the things of this world to attain success in any path, to fulfill any of our desires, and the things of this world are all emanations from Him. So directly and indirectly, we are dependent on Him for our, any success we wish that we may attain. Directly meaning that without His blessings, without the blessings of the super soul, we cannot attain success, and therefore with no bhakti we can attain no success. And also indirectly, because the ingredients or causes of what we are trying to attain also are emanating from Him. The ingredients or causes of what we are using to attain what we want to attain, such as the air, intelligence, our mind, the ingredients of the material world, they also come from Him. So indirectly and directly, both we are dependent on His mercy. How then, if the Supreme Lord arranges all these facilities for the conditioned soul's welfare, can He be impersonal? So that's somewhat of a side point, but it's directly related to some degree as well. And it has to do why that point is being made in the purport, the commentary here, is because the answer to this question is given in a way that impersonalists can also hear it. So if one explains very directly to an impersonalist, they cannot accept it. One cannot directly explain the form of the personality of Godhead to an impersonalist, because due to their consciousness, they see that the form of the personality of Godhead is composed of Maya, and therefore they're called Mayavadis, and they these pastimes of Maya, of the material world, of the three modes, and therefore they're called Mayavadis. But here the point is that actually that's not true, and things are going to be explained indirectly to the impersonalists, but yet the point will be made that the Lord has personal qualities. He can't be impersonal. How can something that is meant for the living entity's benefit, compassionately provided to them for his benefit, be coming from something that has no qualities, that's fully nirguna? Because the quality of providing for, the quality of compassion, the quality of having energies, vrittis, energies and expansions and things, these are all qualities that make him not impersonal. So of course, the Mayavadis take shelter of the answer to that, that there is nothing in existence, in fact. Every variety is just illusion. So, which is ridiculous, obviously, and not at all practical either, because if it's illusion, then the words that they're saying to say that are also illusion, and since they know it's illusion, why are they saying it? Why say illusion and add to the illusion of the world? So they suggest, be quiet. So, in any case, this is the preliminaries in answering the question. Why is this creation occurring? What was the answer that was given?
Because the desire to enjoy his creation.
Okay, but from the point of view, we notice, at least I notice, that everything I desire doesn't happen. So it's not just dependent on my desire. But what is the why is the creation take place according to what was said?
The compassion of the Lord.
Yeah, it's his reciprocation with our desire. So out of his mercy, this takes place. Now we're starting to move towards the answer to this question. How could something material, how could something fully spiritual be described by something dealing within the three modes of material nature? And the answer is hinted at in this way, by saying, by his mercy, this all happens. Let's continue. I'm moving to skipping, which I'm going to have to do when going through this chapter, because there's too much to read, and also not, it's too much to read, and it would be, and everyone would be fast asleep if we read any more than I'm going to do, and maybe we're going to have that problem anyway. But so we're going to skip and jump a bit and just try to capture the essence. So now we're moving to the direct answer of the question. The question Maharaj Prakrit has submitted here, namely, how can the Vedas directly refer to the Absolute Truth, has been answered as follows by Sukadeva Goswami, albeit indirectly. The Lord created intelligence and other elements for the sake of the conditioned living beings. A skeptic, a non-believer, a doubter, may object that this answer is irrelevant. How does that answer the question that, about the Vedas, and how can the Vedas refer to the Absolute Truth? But Sukadeva's answer, Goswami's answer, is not actually irrelevant, as Srila Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur explains. Answers to subtle questions must often be phrased indirectly. As Lord Krishna himself states in his instruction to Uddhava in the 21st chapter, paroksha vad vishaya paroksham mama chapriyam. The Vedic seers and mantras deal in esoteric, hidden, indirect terms, and I am also pleased by such confidential descriptions. In the present context, the impersonalist, on whose behalf Maharaj Prakrit asked this question, cannot appreciate the direct answer. So instead, Srila Sukadeva gives an indirect reply. You say that Brahman is indescribable by words, because words, after all, are emanating from the material mouth and the material tongue and the material mind. But if the Supreme Lord had not created the intelligence, mind and senses, then sound and other objects of perception would all be just as indescribable as your Brahman. So if he didn't give us the means to describe anything in this world, everything would be indescribable. If he didn't give us intelligence, I mean, how could you describe the color white? How would you describe the color white? Well, you could say it's not black, it's not green, it's not red. But how are you going to describe it? How are you going to describe the taste of mango juice? As Prabhupada gave the example, it's of two Britishers talking that mango, oh no, not mango, excuse me, not mango, that's an offense, but jackfruit. There's two kinds of jackfruit, paka and kacha. How do you describe, what is, the one Britisher asked another, what does paka jackfruit taste like? Raise your hand if you've never tasted paka jackfruit. If you've never tasted it, that means you've never tasted it. Now you should ask me, what does it taste like?
What does it taste like?
Well, how are you going to describe what it tastes like? Well, it tastes, as Prabhupada gave the story, it tastes like sugarcane juice strained through a Muslim's beard. That doesn't increase one's taste for jackfruit, pucker jackfruit juice or anything like that, but that's right. How are you going to describe what I personally thought it tasted like? Bubblegum juice or something.
Fragrant bubblegum juice.
Fragrant bubblegum juice. Exactly. Or another way to describe that is like sugarcane juice through a Muslim's beard. So, unless Krishna gave us intelligence, this is... What color is it?
Blue.
How do you know? We're just discussing this topic. Very philosophical topic. Unless Krishna gave us the intelligence and the conceptual ability and the comparative ability, we wouldn't be able to describe anything. Everything would be indescribable. So how is it possible that we are able to describe anything, including sugarcane juice, or for that matter, katal, jackfruit juice, or jackfruit? It is by the gifts of Krishna. And another way of saying that is by the mercy of Krishna. By Krishna's granted ability, the facility that he gives us is his grace. So we take that answer and place it. How can the Vedas describe the absolute truth? The same answer, indirectly spoken, by his grace. This is as our commentators are describing. As in paraphrasing Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. You say that Brahman is indescribable by words, but if the Supreme Lord had not created the intelligence, mind and senses, then sound and the other objects of perception would all be just as indescribable as your Brahman. You would have been blind and deaf since birth and would know nothing about physical forms and sounds. What to speak of the absolute? If a blind person and a deaf person, he knows nothing about sounds and sight. So if Krishna didn't provide the senses and the objects of the senses and the facility for them to interact, everything would be indescribable. But that doesn't mean that everything doesn't exist. It means we'd have no ability to perceive it or say anything about it or describe it in any way. So just as the merciful Lord has given us all facilities, faculties for perception, has given us all faculties of perception for experiencing and describing to others the sensation of sight, sound, and so forth, in the same way he may give someone the receptive capacity to realize Brahman. And this is also very much describes the esoteric secrets of bhakti yoga, which is really dependent on the mercy of the Lord, on Krishna's grace. because we cannot perceive the absolute truth without His grace. There is nothing we can do to perceive Krishna in Braja. How does that make you feel? Helpless, I assume. Or we're helpless when it comes to realization. We need mercy. So that point reflects deeply into the process of bhakti as well. Because it is only by His grace He gives one the receptive capacity to realize something about Braja. And what is it called, or what is someone called, who uses his material faculties to imagine that he's dealing with the spiritual, especially in relationship to Vrindavan? What is that such a person called? Prakriti, yeah, it's Prakriti, Sahaja, especially. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur said that we are all sahajyas in the sense that we take the easy path. But Prakriti sahajyas, we should not be material. It's the material element. Using matter, imagining matter easily, cheaply, imagining our matter to be spirit. Remember when we first came to Vrindavan, I haven't seen one in years, but they used to see the Saki Bekis walking around. You know, these gentlemen wearing saris.
And see them in Delhi.
You know, you also see them in New York. everyone, when they came, they were shocked. But because I'm from New York, you know, everything, you see everything in New York. Nothing is surprising. So you don't see them anymore. At least that's because, maybe because I don't go out of my room at all. but it's that point. So he may, in the same way as he creates the material elements and thereby makes them, and the facilities to make them describable, capacity to describe them and the objects to describe them and the senses, in the same way he may, if he chooses, create some extraordinary way for words to function, apart from their ordinary reference to material substances, qualities, categories, and actions that will enable them to express the absolute truth. He, after all, is the Almighty Lord, Prabhu, and he can easily make the indescribable describable. Now, so the answer is clear? And how the verse relates to the answer is clear. Now, let us move on. Now, Lord Matsya, the Lord Himself, now the next whole section is going to show of this purport, this commentary. I'm quoting from Srila Vishnu Thakavati Thakur, and even Srila Sridhaswami says that they're not making this up either, they're just quoting from capturing the remnants of the previous acharyas. So the next section is going to give examples of Shastra Praman, how showing from Shastra that yes, the absolute truth is describable. Because if the absolute truth wasn't describable by Shastra, then Shastra wouldn't say anything about the absolute truth, other than to say it's indescribable, which itself is a description. So, King Satyavrata is assured by Matsyavatar that the absolute truth can be known from the words of the Vedas. Madhyam mahimanam cha param brahmeti shabditam vetsyasyanu grihitam me samprasna viritam riddhi. This is Shastra Praman. You will be thoroughly advised and favored by me, Lord Matsya is saying. And because of your inquiries, everything about my glories, which are known as Param Brahma, will be manifest within your heart. Thus you will know everything about me. The fortunate soul who has been graced by the Supreme Lord with divine inquisitiveness, will ask questions about the nature of the Absolute. And by hearing the answers given by great sages, which are recorded in the Vedic literatures, he will come to understand the Lord as he is. Thus, only by the special mercy of the Supreme Lord does Brahman become Shabditam, literally denoted by words or described. Otherwise, without the Lord's exceptional grace, the words of the Vedas cannot reveal the Absolute Truth. Sometimes, when asked the question, how, after all, we are in a terrible material world, and we can say that the Lord is compassionate, but what compassion does he show? One of the main answers that Srila Prabhupada and others here has given too, is that he gives us Shastra. Because without Shastra, we who are in matter and our conceptual ability is limited by matter, have no ability to understand anything beyond matter. So therefore, Shastra enters this world as light enters a dark place to give illumination, to give enlightenment. Similarly, the holy names enter. Golokera Premadana Harinama Sankirtan comes from the spiritual world, and the sadhus who embody and carry the Lord's Kripa Shakti also are not of this world, but they are carrying Shakti is of a different realm. Srila Vishnath Chakravarti suggests that the word buddhi in this verse spoken by Sukadev Goswami can indicate the Mahatattva from which evolved the various expansions of ether, such as sound, which are designated here as indriyas. Matrartam then means for the sake of using transcendental sound to describe Brahman, since for that precise purpose the Supreme Lord inspired Prakriti to evolve ether and sound. So this is why these elements have been created, because this material world specifically has been created. This is the point of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. To give facilities for the conditioned soul stuck, trapped, conditioned, controlled by matter, to improve and to go beyond this, to practice sadhana and attain prema bhakti. So not only isn't it true that it can't be described, it's a specific facility given to the living entities specifically by the Supreme Lord. A further understanding of the purpose of creation is spoken by the word vavartam and atmane kalpanaya. If the reading kalpanaya instead of kalpanaya, akalpanaya is taken. Vavartam means for the good of the living entities. Worship, kalpanam, of the Supreme Self, atmane, is the means by which the living entities can fulfill the divine purpose for which they exist. Intelligence, mind, and senses are meant to be used for worshipping the Supreme Lord. So here is an explanation of the Abandhikasism, Bandha Yukta Varagya. Things aren't to be renounced. They're supposed to be renounced in the positive sense. It is used in the service of he whom they belong to. So everything is meant to be used in the worship of the Supreme Lord, whether or not the living entity has brought them to the stage of transcendental perfection. How both purified and unpurified devotees use their intelligence, mind, and senses in worshipping the Lord is described in reference to the following quote from the Gopaltapani Upanishad. Important quote and an important point. So everything should be used for the service of the Lord because it's created by Him. So the question is, well, that's for perfected souls, but how about those who are unperfected, not yet perfected? So that's the question that's going to be answered, how both purified and unpurified devotees, so a very relevant point, use their intelligence, mind, and senses in worshipping the Lord. So the reference is to Gopaltapani Upanishad. Satpundarikanayanam megabhyam vidutambaram dvibhujam monamudradhyam vanamalinamishwaram. The Supreme Lord Please listen carefully to this last section of the second verse, because it's very sweet and wonderful. The Supreme Lord, appearing in his two-arm form, had divine lotus eyes, a complexion the color of a, and garments that resembled lightning. He wore a garland of forest flowers, and his beauty was enhanced by his pose of meditative silence. The transcendental intelligence and senses of the Lord's perfect devotees correctly perceive his purely spiritual beauty, and their realizations are echoed in the Gopal Tapani Shruti's comparison of Lord Krishna's eyes, body, and clothing to a lotus, a cloud, and lightning. So one type of devotee, perfected, purified devotee, he uses his senses in directly perceiving the Lord. And his direct perceptions, his realized direct perceptions, what he's actually perceiving, are written down in Shastra, such as this Gopal Tapani Upanishad verse. So this is what he's perceiving, and he's comparing the Lord's dhoti, his form and beauty, etc., his eyes, to a lotus, a cloud, and light. Now, moving to those devotees who are not yet perfected and not fully purified. On the other hand, devotees on the level of sadhana, who are in the process of becoming purified, have only barely realized the Supreme Lord's boundless spiritual beauty. What does boundless mean?
Unlimited.
There is no boundary to it. There is no limit to it. Like if you fly in the sky, if you're a bird, according to a bird's capacity, how high he can go is limited. According, parrots only go at one distance. Crows go fly at another height, and hawks fly at another height, and vultures fly at another height. What is that called in the airports? There's a person, the flight controller or something like that, who makes sure everyone doesn't crash, all the planes don't crash.
Control tower.
In the tower there's the person who makes, who coordinates everyone. So Krishna does that with all the birds, so they don't crash into each other. And the mosquitoes fly at one level, etc., etc. So, this is how the sadhakas become purified, who are not yet purified. They have only barely realized the Supreme Lord's boundless spiritual beauty. Nonetheless, by hearing scriptural passages such as this from the Gopal Tapani Upanishad, they engage in contemplating him to the best of their fledgling ability. Fledgling means, it refers to birds who have not yet learned how to fully fly. So according to their ability and maturity, they'll contemplate the Lord based on what the purified devotees have realized and written down. So although the neophyte devotees have not yet learned how to fully realize the Lord or meditate steadily on even the effulgence surrounding his body, still they take pleasure in presuming we are meditating on our Lord. And indeed, they are meditating on their Lord, on maybe not the most complete level, but they're approaching the Lord. How does the Supreme Lord react to those who are making this attempt? And the Supreme Lord, moved by the waves of his boundless mercy, himself thinks, these devotees are meditating on me. He doesn't think they're so foolish. He doesn't think they're just imagining things in their mind. He doesn't think, what are they doing? He doesn't think like that. He thinks they are meditating on me. Their conception is pointed towards me, even though it's imperfectly realized. This is the Lord's boundless mercy. So as the birds are limited in their height because they are not unbounded in their capacity. Krishna is quite different. He's unbounded in his mercy. There's a limit to each of us, how high each of us birds can fly. But there's no limit to how much Krishna can descend into our consciousness, into this world. That is good or not good? What do you think? It's very good. When the devotion matures, he draws them to his feet to engage in his intimate service. Thus it is concluded that the Vedas have access to the personal identity of the Supreme only by his mercy. Those, text 3. Any questions about the question or the answer? As to the intended meaning? Yes.
So how many purposes are there according to this verse? Are there 3 or 4?
I'm sorry. How many purposes?
For creating this world. The verse says, the Lord created this, the senses, the intelligence, and so forth.
Oh, yes.
For this, and for this.
He gives 3 there, but those aren't the only ones. But because it's basically Dhamma, Artha, Kama, and Moksha.
Dhamma, Artha, Kama, and so forth.
But then there's the ultimate purposes, so that the Prema Bhaktas can do their sadhana, or the devotees can do their sadhana and attain Prema, which is the ultimate purpose.
It will be either the 5th or the ultimate 4th.
There's another one too that I've heard, that because Brahma, his devotee, has a tendency to create the material world, that's what he wants to do, so he says, okay.
That would be Artha.
But it's not, because it's his devotee. It's just to reciprocate with his devotee, Brahma.
According to this verse, itself, it would be like first one is sense gratification, sense enjoyment. Second one is for repeated births, bhava. And then my main.
But it's not. You could say that the second one, take repeated births, is really the first one, because it's to fulfill their desires, material desires. So it's just a different way of explaining the same thing. In other words, you could also describe it as one thing. All these, including the desire for liberation, are actions within the realm of false ego. You could describe it as one.
Anyway, my question is about the last 2 points here. Because
the last 2 points in the verse? Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it says, Atmane Akalpanayata. So are these 2 different or are they the same? Because in the translation it comes as become elevated in the future lives and ultimately attain liberation. So are these...
Okay, he talked about the 2 meanings of also kalpanaya or kalpanaya. And what does he say about that again?
Mercy of the Lord.
I'm going to have to find it again. Atmane kalpanaya means... for the good of living entities, for worship, kalpanam. And apakam.
On page 601.
Yes, I have it.
So here they are taken as one, Atmana, Kalpana.
So the abandonment of material motives, which means more the liberation side, or for his worship. But what's the deeper point you're getting at, or is it just one of how many reasons are there?
Yeah, how many reasons are there? According to our DVD translation, there are 4. But the last 2 are similar. Become elevated and ultimately attain liberation.
So you're talking about it from the Sanskrit point of view?
Yes.
And we can look at another translation and see if there are other ones to translate or enumerate. But what is the concept that circumscribes those four or three or five?
That our confusion is usually that there is only one purpose to this world, which is enjoyment. And the answer is that these same things that are for enjoyment, they're also simultaneously created for another purpose, which is getting up. So that's why this same senses that bind us can also make us unbound through the Veda.
Yeah, that's a nice way of saying it. So, okay, how does that come to? Is that what was that your the answer to your question, or is that what was behind what was?
Yeah, it's behind. Still, I was just thinking whether you were analyzing how many.
See, what I tend to look for in these things is the concept that circumscribes whether it's four or three or five or ten. And the concept is, and you put it very nicely, there's a dual concept there. But the primary reason is that the Lord makes the material world to give the souls a realm in which they can exercise their false ego in. But that same realm can be used to dissolve the false ego by the mercy of the Lord coming in different forms, such as the Shastra and the Sadhu. They teach specifically how to turn the bars of the prison into facility for advancement, either especially through bhakti, because through the path of jnana, the bars aren't changed into anything, they're just ignored, and, you know, forgetting that I'm in prison, I'm identifying with something else. Seeing the bars is not really there. But in bhakti, the same things that imprison one within an enjoying spirit are transformed into the cause of happiness. So therefore, visvapurna sukhayate. And therefore, Prabhupada could walk through in the early days through New York City and look at everything, look at big Carnegie, ancient famous Carnegie Hall. Look at the huge buildings owned by the Jehovah's Witnesses, and thinking about how he would like to have a press like that, and how he could convert this Carnegie Hall into a temple. So seeing everything with its connection to Krishna through his service, which means the absence of false ego, which means the absence of enjoying spirit. This is the crux of bhakti, and this is, one could say, the essence of what we're trying to do. And it has to do with the vision created, superimposed upon the soul by the false ego. Follow me? Yeah, the vision superimposed on the soul by false ego, which causes us to see everything in the material world as if it is meant for our pleasure. And oh, that gives us so much suffering, and that fruit of mentality is born from that. And when we engage the fruit of mentality piously according to Shastra, we remain in the material world and go up on Brahma Bhuvanaloka to the highest planet, to the lowest planet again and again. If we engage it against Shastra, or we could say the poor mama monster tries to accumulate so much piety, and that's going to come up in the later verses, that they just stay up forever in the material world. And if we engage our enjoying spirit in impious ways, we just go down into hellish regions. But it's all within the realm of false ego. So the sadhaka, his job is to change his identity from false ego to real ego. And the symptom of that is his spirit. His spirit, his bhava, his mood of, am I a servant or am I a master? It comes down to that, a simple binary question. I'm a servant or a master? And if I'm a master, there's so many different forms it's going to take. 8,400,000, basically. And if I'm a servant, it depends on the mood of my service, what form I'm going to take. But here, do you want to speak any more about this? Or did you get the answer you were looking for to some degree? So why don't we move on, because we have to get to because it's going to be a pushing in these till the end. We finish this chapter because the purports are thick. So those who came, this is the third verse. Those who came before even our ancient predecessors meditated upon the same confidential knowledge of the absolute truth. So we've just heard a lot, actually. It sounds very simple and for us obvious. But this was the ancient predecessors, in other words, the great acharyas in the past, they meditated upon this same confidential knowledge of the absolute truth, that it is given, that from him emanates so many things by his mercy for the purpose of getting more of his mercy. If we want to take his mercy and enjoy with it, we can do that. If we want to take his mercy and get full mercy, we can do that. Indeed, anyone who faithfully concentrates on this knowledge will become free from material attachments and attain the final goal of life. So it's very weighty what Sukadeva has said, even though it's nothing that attracts our unintellectual tendencies. In fact, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, in the final paragraphs, short paragraph of the purport, says, in the opinion of Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, the first two verses of this chapter can be considered an Upanishad on the topic of Brahman. Sukadeva Goswami here disclaims authorship on the grounds that this Upanishad was spoken previously by Narada Muni, who himself heard it from Shanakamara. In this connection, about this Upanishad, about the answer to this question, about can the Vedas, the question is, can the Vedas who are of this world dealing with the three modes of material nature, can they describe transcendence which is beyond this world? So in this connection, as to what the Vedas describe, and that they do describe the absolute truth on different levels, according to the different realizations of the Vedas, Sukadeva says, I will relate to you a narration concerning the Supreme Lord Narayan. It is about a conversation that once occurred between Sri Narayan Rishi and Narada Muni. So we'll read directly from Bhishma Chakravarti Thakur on this, because there's no very short purport. Sukadeva Goswami said, these two famous verses, 1 and 2, in the form of a question and answer, can be considered an Upanishad on the topic of Brahman, the Brahma Upanishad. These verses were not created by us, but simply made their appearance, because this Upanishad was spoken previously by Narada Muni himself. Same. 5. Once, while traveling along among the various planets of the universe, the Lord's beloved devotee, Narada, went to visit the primeval sage, Narayan, in his ashram. From the very beginning of Brahma's day, Lord Narayan Rishi has been undergoing austere penances in this land of Bharata, while perfectly performing religious duties and exemplifying spiritual knowledge and self-control, all for the benefit of human beings in both this world and the next. There, Narada approached Lord Narayan Rishi, who was sitting amidst sages in the village of Kalap. After bowing down to the Lord, O hero of the Kurus, Narada asked him the very same question you asked me. Mr. Chakravarti Thakur comments. So what was the question?
Can the Vedas describe absolute truth?
And phrased here, can the Shrutis, which means the Vedas, describe the indescribable Brahman? How can something indescribable be described? As the sages listen, Lord Narayan Rishi relates to Narada an ancient discussion, another past story inside the story, about the absolute truth that took place among the residents of Janaloka. The personality of Godhead said, so who is the personality of Godhead that is saying here?
Narayan Rishi.
O son of self-born Brahma, who is he speaking to? Narada. Once, long ago, on Janaloka, wise sages who resided there performed a great sacrifice to the Absolute Truth by vibrating transcendental sound. These sages, mental sons of Brahma, were all perfect celibates. Purport. Srila Sridhar Swami explains that the word satram here refers to a Vedic sacrifice in which all the participants are equally qualified to serve as priests. In this instance, each of the sages present in Janaloka could speak equally well on the topic of Brahman. At that time, because this is explaining why he wasn't there, at that time you happened to be visiting the Lord on Swetadeep, that Supreme Lord in whom the Vedas lie down to rest during the period of universal annihilation. So which Lord is that? The Lord of Swetadeep? At that time, and you weren't there and you didn't hear it then, a lively discussion arose amongst the sages on Janaloka as to the question of the Supreme Absolute Truth. Indeed, the same question arose then that you are asking me now. Although these sages were all equally qualified in terms of Vedic study and austerity, and although they saw all friends, enemies, and neutral parties equally, they chose one of their number to be the speaker, and the rest became eager listeners. Sri Sanandana replied, so he was chosen. After the Supreme Lord withdrew the universe he had previously created, he lay down for some time as if asleep, and all of his energies rested dormant within him. When the time came for the next creation, the personified Vedas awakened him by chanting his glories. Now here is an important point already. Just as the poets serving a king approach him at dawn and awaken him by reciting his heroic deeds. So, what are the Vedas doing? What are the Shrutis doing? And this is the main point, because soon, starting in the next verse, 14, verses 14 to 20, for the next 28 verses, because there's 28 major Shrutis, so 14 to 42, and this is what this chapter is composed of, basically. The preliminary, leading up the questions, and leading up to the words of the Shrutis. And there are 50 verses in this chapter. So most of them, 14 to 42, are the preliminary and the post-verses. Those 28 verses are the essence of the chapter. And what they're going to be doing, they represent, each of the 28 verses represent a different Shruti. a different Upanishad, a different Vedic literature. And the Vedic literatures, their purpose, when they're reciting, they're each going to say one verse, and their purpose is, Shurdakshan Vishnu is lying there at the time of the, after the annihilation, it's time for the creation to begin, and they're waking him up. And what are they doing? They're glorifying him. So what's the point that I'm trying to make? Is that the purpose of all the Vedas, directly, indirectly, on one level or another, according to the realization of that particular Veda or Shruti, they will glorify the Lord, either on the level of Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan. But it's all glorification of the Absolute Truth. Answering the question that the purpose of the Vedas is simply to glorify the Lord and showing that ultimately the Vedas are going to be glorifying the Bhagavan understanding of the Absolute Truth. Because that is the understanding that all the other understandings rest upon. So that's basically what's happened here up to this point. So they're chanting His glories. They're glorifying Him. You have come. You think of Rangaji when we see your effulgent features. When the time came for the next creation, the personified Vedas awakened him by chanting his glory. So all the words of the Vedas are his glories on different levels. Just as poets serving a king approach him as dawn and awaken him by reciting his heroic deeds. So what's going to happen in the next verses is that our great acharyas will show how each of the verses that they speak is a glorification ultimately, or a description. A description of the Lord. Because He's not undescribable by the mercy of the Lord. That which is beyond the senses is understood and can be described by the learned seers. We'll just read the purport and then we shall break for a break. Purport. At the time of creation, the Vedas are the first emanation from the breathing of Lord Mahavishnu. And in personified form, they serve him by waking him from his mystic sleep. So someone said Mahavishnu is who is being spoken to. Who said that? It appears. Yeah. But in Swatadeep, the Lord is Kiradasa Vishnu. This statement made by Sanandana implies that Shanaka and the other sages had asked him the same question that Narada had asked Narayan Rishi and Maharaj Parikit had asked Sukadeva Goswami. Sanandana refers the question back to the example of the personified Vedas themselves in their address to Lord Mahavishnu. Even though the Vedas knew that the Lord, being omniscient, does not need to be informed of his glories, they enthusiastically took this opportunity to praise him. 13, this is something a little different, or more different. Okay, so this is the introduction. That was the introduction to this chapter, and that what remains in today's class and tomorrow's class will be to one by one hear the words of the Shrutis and see what they have to say about the Lord and try to get a feeling for what they're, for how they're describing the Supreme Lord and what characteristics, specific characteristics are they describing about him.